The interview right now.
Well, good.
Hey, my name is Matthew Rozelle. We're at Hudson Falls High School. Today is January 23rd, 2009. It's the last day of our World War II class. Our seniors will be moving on to better courses in the springtime. And we're lucky, fortunate today because we have a veteran of the Second World War, a Pacific Marine. His name's Herb L. Schuler. And I'll ask Herb some questions today. And hopefully he'll tell us his story of World War II. Okay, so Herb, can you tell me what day were you born?
6/6/24.
6/6/1924?
Yes.
Little 20 years, so you were 20 years old on D-Day.
Well, I related to where I was on Pearl Harbor. I was in Tampa, Florida, living in a rooming house and eating at a boarding house with about 16 guys, and I was taking a course in Tampa U in surveying. And that became a very important part of this whole life story. The day of Pearl Harbor, after we ate breakfast, half of these guys disappeared. They all joined up. I was not ready to do that. But the fellow who was giving, the gentleman who was giving the course in surveying at Tampa U, was a dredging captain, and he was mapping 600 acres between Tampa and Plant City for the person who owned the company, Captain Henry, who owned Henry Dredging Corporation. And he needed somebody to hold his rod and do his chaining, measuring, and he asked if anybody wanted to do that, and I quickly did that because I had no other source of income, and I went to work for him. He picked me up in the morning. We went out, we mapped, we had a whole crew where we actually had machetes and cut palmettos for right-of-ways where we mapped this. It was a great experience, and in the middle of this, he got called on an assignment as a dredging captain, and he says, "Herb, can you take over? Now I'm just a kid." And I said, "Sure." And I took over the mapping of the 600 acres and met the owner, because it was his property that he was developing, and he took a liking to me. He was almost a father figure at the time. And he liked me, and he put me on one of his dredges at Key West, and I also was on a tugboat taking that dredge up to Panama City. And it was that time that I either was going to have to stay with that company, because these guys were exempt, they were doing government work, or join, because I know I was going to be drafted at that point. And I just took the attitude that you're not going to draft me, I'm going to join. And if I'm going to join, I'm going to join the most active part of what I thought was the armed forces. And I joined the Marine Corps in Orlando, Florida. And from Orlando, I went up to Parris Island for boot camp. Now, you have to understand, boot camp is where they change you from a citizen to a Marine. And it's done by beating you over the head, practically. I mean, there's a couple of ways of doing things, but there's only one way. The Marines will accept it. And you go in, you get your hair shaved, you get your clothes, you learn to make a bed that you can bounce a coin off, and it better come up or it'll be ripped up again. And you are physically challenged, and all you do is learn to be a Marine. You learn to take a rifle apart, put it back together blindfolded. You learn to march, you learn discipline, you learn to do what's told, and when you clean up, either pick it up, or if you can't pick it up, you paint it. And you really have an experience that's a life-changing experience. I was in physical shape. You have to look at an old man here right now, but you can visualize somebody like yourself, 18 years old, 135 pounds, ready to beat the world up. And I was really wanted to do that. You were doing it because you were doing it for your country. It was very patriotic. There was no nonsense about who was with and who was what not. you were there and you did your job. And from at Paris Island, by the way, they give you when you go in, they give you an aptitude test too. Now here I had this experience, and that's why I mentioned it, of surveying, and I took this aptitude test, and the last week you're there, you do KP, you do duty of scrubbing down the mess hall, setting it up. You're just a week of nothing but kitchen work. And then at the end, they tell you where you're going. And I was very pleased. They sent me up to Camp Lejeune, to the engineering battalion, where I took a course on surveying. Now, you have to understand that I was really ahead of my little group of 15 guys, because I was actually had done some and was very familiar. And consequently, at the end of the course, which was given by a lieutenant who was an engineer, and he was given one sergeant's appointment, two corporals, I think, and about four PFCs, and I was very conscientious, and I became a sergeant after that school, was a specialty in surveying. And now you're a sergeant. Believe me, you can be a sergeant of any specialty you want, but you're a sergeant. And so you quickly pick up duties as a sergeant. I became sergeant of a platoon going through the engineering battalion. And every, I think it was 6 or 8 weeks, I'd get a new platoon, and I'd get a new second lieutenant, a 90-day wonder that came out of Quantico. And this was his first experience, and they assigned me a corporal. And that was done after every one of these sessions. And these sessions were marching from one specialty to another, demolition, heavy equipment, and all the parts of the engineering battalion had a week of training. So you went through that, but the real tricky part of this deal was discipline. You have to know that I marched these men every day to every meal, brought them out in the morning, inspected them. They shaved every morning. If they never shaved in their life, you shave every day. You learn to do things without questioning, because you learned how to use a bayonet, you learned to use a rifle, and you learned to keep yourself in shape. And at that point, these new lieutenants coming down, they too were learning and getting into the story, and they would have a session with this platoon. And I remember this one lieutenant who came in, and these were all smart, bright guys. They just didn't have any experience other than being taught up at Quantico. And he taught them how to cross their rifles, which were M1s, and take a poncho and tie it around the bottom and take their helmet between the rifles and the ponchos for buoyancy, to get a little, if you can visualize, a little raft arrangement with two cross rifles, a helmet to hold on. And we did that one afternoon, and unbeknownst to anybody, he broke that platoon out, and we went for a march down to the river. Get to the river, we're going to cross this river with this lesson that this lieutenant had learned. And it was scary to me. I didn't know who could swim, who couldn't swim. And I remember telling these men that any of them couldn't go over that bridge and walk over. And a couple of them did. Anyway, the lieutenant went in first. And then they made up their little pontoons. And we started across. The corporal went to the right flank, and I was bringing up the rear. I never got in the water. Halfway down, one guy yells, "Help!" And the other guy yells, "Help!" Before you know it, we lose a guy, drowned him in training. There's an inquiry.
He died?
Died, very much dead. And you get, that was the first death I really experienced in service. It really, I remember it to this day exactly how it all happened. And there was an inquiry, and I remember these officers saying, "Now, next time, put a rope up." And I said to myself, you know, it's silly to lose people in training, but you lose them. And then the next platoon I took through, another lieutenant, but they all had to go through these sort of things. The last week of the training course, you have to understand, we went to each one of these heavy different divisions for 4 or 5 of them. This course was 6 to 8 weeks. But the last week, we went out to the beach, bivouacking, and you built a fortification with sandbags and barbed wire. And then you took that platoon out, you brought it in, and attacked it and blew it up. That was the graduation. And I remember this also very clearly, that up on the ridge were all these dignitaries watching this trained platoon to come in and attack this little fortification. Well, one of the things you do is you take a demolition pack, which is like a little knapsack with explosives in it, and you make yourself with one of the square, I don't even know what the hell that was. It wasn't made of TNT, I don't know. But you put a starter and a cap in there, and then you have an actual fuse, and then you have a lighter. The lighter is nothing more than something you pull, it makes a spark, it hits the fuse, and the fuse goes down, burns, and sets the cap off. And every one of those had to be inspected by a lieutenant before, an officer, before you could actually go through with a training experience. Well, we did all of that, and then we attacked, and you go through as a fighting platoon with BARs on the outside, get these guys and blow up the barbed wire. And the culmination, of course, is you fire until you get to the thing, and the guy with the pack goes up, puts it on, and pulls it. Now, when you do that, you make sure that the fuse is a U shape, so if the spark goes out, it doesn't hit the cap. Well, we missed that procedure. Lieutenant didn't really look, he didn't have it tied, and we blew this guy up. And I can remember that, just going up, we put him, sent him home in a bag, and that was another shocking thing that I visualized all the time. Anyway, that is some of the things that are done in training that you don't hear of. They're not heroes, but it's part of the hell of becoming what you had to become. Well, from there, from Camp Lejeune, I joined the 4th Marine Division on Maui, went out to California, got onto a boat in San Francisco in the harbor there. We waited till we had a bunch of boats together, and then we went out to Maui. Now, again, as a sergeant who was really a surveying sergeant, you had a platoon again. You sat there and you actually read the letters of anybody who wanted to mail anything for censorship. Why I was any better than anybody else, but there I was reading everybody's sad stories. And you were stacked up in this boat. You also stood sergeant of the guard duty on the ship. And in Maui, I was assigned a platoon of reserves. I wasn't doing anything that I was trained at that school for, but being a sergeant, I was a drill instructor, and I really had a good platoon. I had men there that I admired, and I was taking all the material given to me, and I was a pretty good, I could handle my job with great confidence, and I enjoyed what I was doing at that time, because until you have to get into the blood and stuff, it's a big Boy Scout, it's a big fun thing almost for you. It's not the tragic parts when you see people die. Anyway, we shipped out of camp, out of Maui for Iwo. And I remember we left, I stood Sergeant of the Guard on Maui for our platoon, or our regiment. And they let everybody out of the brig. It was Christmas And if you weren't in there for some horrendous thing, you were left free. And so that Christmas and New Year's, these guys had a hell of a time. And then we boarded ships, and it was a month, I guess, that we went to and landed in Maui. Now, the startling thing is getting on deck.
You said you left Maui. What year was this now? Is this 45?
Yes.
Most of that, huh?
Yes. Amazing. I have all these things down. I'm doing it without looking at them. I had a platoon of men that were kind of come in a reserve. And the first day, again, these are the things you remember. When you approached the island, came up in the morning, you got on deck. As far as you could see on the horizon, all the way around, were nothing but ships. It was like a fairy tale. I mean, you looked out there, and all there was is close, with no spaces between, ships. And all the armament on these battleships were just laying it in. You could not visualize and imagine how a little island like that could have anybody living in it with the amount of firepower that came from those ships into Iwo. And the men would, you know, when you go onto a landing craft off a ship, you go down a net with your gear on. And the first day, I saw the guy get caught between the net and a landing craft and get crushed. And we, that night, because I didn't go until the next morning, the next day, we went out a ways. And something you want to remember is to see a fellow Marine buried at sea with taps and letting them go over the sides. Those things stay with you as the price to be there. And the next day, I went in with my platoon. Now, I had guys there that were really well-trained, and I had taught them everything they taught me that we went in. And when you hit the shore, it's a volcanic island with black sand that you sunk in as you came in. And we were to get in as far as we could go. Now, the first day from Mount Sarabachi to the highland up on the north, they had registered the whole beach with these large, large mortars, and they were just coming in. The guys got slaughtered that first day all through there. We came in, and we pushed past the sand up and into, call them foxholes. There were holes that were done by ammunition, by mortars, and that sort of thing. It was a mess just to get there, but we stayed there. And I remember that night sleeping in what was a foxhole, scared as hell, and thinking of all the things I didn't do, all the things I wanted in life that I was not going to maybe not see. And I was very, very frightened. And I slept with that rifle next to me. At that time, I was carrying a carbine. And your whole life goes before you. It did for me, anyway, at that moment. And right in the middle of all this thinking and visualizing and fantasizing, this recon comes up, a recon being a small truck with rockets, big mess of rockets, pulled up right behind me, not 5 feet from me, and let go the salvage of all of those. Now, that's nothing but a big blast and light and noise, and then they backed off and went away. And I just knew that was the end of me. They had me registered, the light was there, that's where the next thing was in. But it didn't, and I fell asleep finally. And when I woke up, we all moved up, and there was a guy with a clipboard who assigned the men for different areas, and there were officers they were assigned to when they were moving up. And this is why I told you about the surveying. got to me. He says, "Sergeant, there's a vacancy up at regimental headquarters for the artillery," because that's what I was trained to do, was to do, what we did was make a baseline and correct targets and the map from that baseline. And there I was. I can tell you, you have to be lucky. I was sent back there, and that's what I did. And I never got scratched. I was scared, and I lived through it, and I ate K rations to begin with, which were like Cracker Jacks with hardtack in them, and C rations, which were cans. And I saw the smartest guys buried, and some of the real dope-offs living. So you do the best, you try to best yourself, but there's, in war, you have to be lucky too. And I'll always remember the last day I was on E-Roll. I sat up on a high piece of land, looked down at the ceremony at the cemetery, where heavy equipment had just plowed a field, laid these guys out, surveyed them out. There was a flagpole. They buried the dogs, these lovely, lovely animals around the flagpole. They were taking messages back from the forward observers back, as well as Navajos that we had that talked back. And that was something to see. We lost, I think I took down the number of that we lost on Iwo. We wanted to keep that number. It was 6,800 dead on this little island. The Japanese lost about 20,000. Now, you imagine a little island here with 26,000 people, 27,000 people giving up their lives. Think of nobody who went back and was loused up about it. But anyway, I went back ashore and the thing back on ship. And let me tell you, to take a hot shower and have a hot meal and smell fresh bread, you think that the world has come back to you. And from there, I went back to Maui. The 4th Marine Division was sent home, but I didn't have enough time in to be able to go back with the 4th, because that was the only thing I had ever done. And they sent me to China. I went to Okinawa, and then from Okinawa to China. And I was at Tsingtao, China, cold as hell, on the Yellow Sea. And we were surveying the runways at the airfield in Tsingtao, China. Well, I had a marvelous experience at Tsingtao, China. One of the funny things, as we came into harbor off that ship, here I saw all these little people coming out to welcome us in these boats. And I said, "Isn't that fantastic?" All these little boats were coming out to greet us. And as we got approached, these guys were doing nothing but following the ships, picking up the garbage. These people were really bad, bad, bad shape. We went to Tsingtao for the occupancy, because Japan had that, and we took over from the Japanese in that area. But I had a marvelous part in there, and I want to make sure I have some time for you to ask questions. But I went back home. Being a sergeant, you were assigned a bunch of guys, you took them by train, and I was discharged in Camp Lejeune, went home, and I met a young lady when I was on leave. I looked her up, took her out, and at that time, because of the GI Bill, I went back to school, and on my first vacation, my first Christmas break, I got married. Married for 60 some years to this lovely woman, and we have three great young men. They're 50, 53, and 56, and I'll tell you, I look back at it as having done a lot for me, but it's funny. in my generation, I went to work from, by the way, my wife became pregnant in my second year, and I had to go to work. I decided to go to work. And I went to work for one firm and worked for them until I retired at 71 and sent three boys from college and had a second home in Columbia County. And now I'm retired in a marvelous, marvelous retirement community at the Glen at the Meadows, up Highland Meadows. So I've been blessed and I've had a marvelous life. But I want to tell you, you people, every generation's different. You're going to have another. You've got some big problems. But one of the things I hope you do is try to prevent war, because it's hell. That's my story.
Well, we have some questions for you, too.
Good.
Now, were you from Glens Falls originally?
No. I was born and reared in Newark, New Jersey. I brought my... when I worked, when I could afford it, I bought a home in Livingston, New Jersey, a suburb of Newark. And when I further succeeded, I bought a farm in Chatham, New York. We did that because we were campers and we went north and camped. But one day my wife said, "You're not going to get me in a tent again." And I went and I rented a little farmhouse for our vacation. We liked it. So I looked and we bought a farm. We bought a 100-acre farm in Columbia County, and we used it weekends and holidays until I retired. I retired there and it got a little too much for us. We moved up here.
From Chatham up to Glens Falls?
Yes, we were using our Albany Med for our medical, mm-hmm. and we were supposed to go to Niskayuna, the Glen Eddy. Eddie has a place in Niskayuna, but when we got to do that, there was no room, and they suggested coming here, and it was a great move. We're here about 3.5, almost 4 years. We love it up here. We love the whole area, and what I can see of young people, we even love all you young people.
They're an impressive group. They were eager to come over and talk to you. So... do we have some questions for our Pacific Marine, Andrea?
After you got discharged and stuff, what did you?
I can hear you.
After you were not in the military anymore, what was your job?
Okay.
What did you go on for your further profession?
I was very fortunate. I was going to Newark College of Engineering, and then on the board there was this job that in climate control company who was actually a contractor and distributor of Chrysler Air Temp heating and air conditioning equipment. I went to work for a gentleman who was calling on architects, and so I started calling on architects. I then became a salesman, and then I became a sales manager for the heating and cooling part of that business, and then I became a vice president. Finally, I ran the operation as senior vice president. It's a hard thing. Young people don't have those opportunities. Each one of my kids have had more than one or two different careers, and it seems to be the logical thing, but I don't know. I just had a wonderful, loved my work, and that's another thing. I would suggest that you find something you love when you decide to go to work. But until then, get all the education you can.
Did you go to college?
I had 2 years of college.
GI Bill help?
GI Bill did it. In fact,
what was the GI Bill, just to explain?
When we got out of service, there were lots of things available to us as veterans, and one, of course, was the GI Bill of Rights that paid our tuition while we went to school. And I got married at my first break, and my wife was working, and but it got me there. I don't know if I would have gotten there without it. In fact, the funny part of that was you also got, and I think it was on the back of this that there might have been a little notation printed on there, that you had a number that permitted you to, we needed a bedroom set. And to get a bedroom set those days, there wasn't much wood. You went to a furniture store, and if you had a certificate, the guys were very happy to sell you because they could get replacement for it because they sold it to a GI. Wow.
I never heard that before.
That's, I think one of our kids is still sleeping in that bed.
Good stuff.
Did you have something?
Yeah, do you still keep in touch with anyone that, like anyone that you fought with or that you were
well,
with?
I'll tell you, and I may be in the minority of this, because someone once asked me that before. Until speaking with you, I've never told my story. I never joined a veterans organization. I never fought the war. I never went drinking with the guys. And it was something that, I'll tell you something. What I'm telling you, you ought to go back if you have any grandparents and get to talk to them, because I've never talked to my kids about the war. I never talked to my father about his experiences. You have a tendency not to get into that with them. It's a great thing to do. I always regret the fact that I didn't have that smarts to do that with my father, because he would have let me know. But I didn't. I didn't. I really didn't. The only thing I ever did close is I took one of my uniforms and gave it to one of my grandchildren to use for Halloween. That's as close as I got to doing anything.
That's not that uncommon, though, from what I find. And I find it's actually. I never talked to my father. He was a Korean War vet. Here now, you have over 100 World War II veteran interviews. Yeah, I never even talked to my own father about it.
Yeah,
and I think it's really important that people like you do have a chance to share your experiences with these people. And my generation, we never, thank God, had to go to war. And I'm really glad you came in.
I hope you people can avoid that as well. As you know, I had an opportunity to do this interview at the Glen, and they have an audience of peers there, of people, and I said to the person who was organizing this, says I would do it for young people, for students, but I have no desire to tell my story to a bunch of old people like me. And I hope you enjoyed or got something from it.
Yeah. But I still have some more questions. We have more questions here.
I also want to thank Mark. He did a terrific job, and I was so proud to be there to listen to him because he handled himself so well. I heard of some people who didn't get to talk to you, but I was so pleased to give that time. Mark came to the cottage, and we had a little time together, and I think you did a great job, Mark.
How long were you on Iwo Jima? Were you there for the whole battle?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, I was parked for the first day there, right before the airport, the runway, got in about there. And then I went to regimental, which was also at the other end of the runway. The battle itself was up to Suribachi, where they put up the flag. And nothing but caves all the way up. And you saw the flamethrowers and you heard the noise. They were dug in. They could stay there. And the guys just kept on going. It's altogether different than the wars that are being played today. It doesn't resemble anything like that. But I was there. It was only a month, the whole business.
It was a long month, though.
Yes, yes, it was. And as I say, other than the shock of seeing guys in those training times and the guys on the beach and seeing the cemetery, The rest of the time was great. If you go, if you can join the service and they guarantee you don't have to shoot or go to war, it's a hell of a good experience. They don't guarantee that.
No. Did you see the flag? Do you remember the flag raising or anything?
I don't remember the raising, but I remember the flag. I mean, it took place not ceremonially, as far as I was concerned. I was pretty close. I was closer to Sarabachi than I was to the other end of the island.
That's what we're looking at here. That's Sarabachi.
This is Sarabachi. Yeah. We came in over here. This was all high, and that's where they have all the underground material.
Tunnels and
caves. And the airfields from here. One of the things you saw flying back and forth over the island were these little planes, our little one-wing, one-motor spotters that went back and forth looking for targets. But I was lucky. And I was lucky because I did that surveying down in Tampa, and I always think that's what saved me, and that's what gave me this opportunity.
So you had the skill to really put you behind the scenes to orchestrate the fire.
The fact that I had the survey got me to survey school. The fact that I had the little edge on people got me a sergeant's rank, and from that point on, I had an experience that was, I think, stood me well in my career for the rest of my life. I learned how to handle people. I came back mature. You know, one of the things you do in service, I don't know if other people did, but I thought a great deal about what I wanted to do with my life. I started to evaluate what was real and what wasn't real, what was worth doing, and I came home knowing that I wanted to be part of a community. I wanted to be part of a family. I just thought those were the worthwhile things in life. And that's why I guess I married when I did, quite early after I got back. I was careful to know I found somebody that was a good kisser, and a great warm person, and a person who had my values. And we were very fortunate. We raised three great kids, and I'm proud of where I've been, and I'm just thankful and so happy that I'm really lucky, because I'm living a lifestyle, a worthwhile type of life, where I go to concerts, go to Hyde, go down to Saratoga, to SPAC, go to Lake George. This is a great country. And I'm fortunate enough that I can partake of that.
So your service obviously was a turning point for you as a young person.
It certainly marks who I am. That generation of people who went through service, their life coming out of it was marked and was directed from there, I'm sure. A lot of people go in different directions. You go to these. I've always been part of Trout Unlimited since I've been up here, and some of the meetings are at some of the veterans' places. And guys, and I'm a scotch drinker, and I like to have a drink socially. But you see people who have spent, the veterans who have. Gathered together around bars to fight the war, that had been scarred and it became the thing, the dominant part of their lives. It's a very difficult thing for me to see. And yet, people of my age who have been very, very successful have come out of the same experience. So you can be what you can be, and you can be whatever you want. Choose your friends. Give it hell, do the best you can, and you'll come on top. I always felt, and I always told my boys, that the majority of people do not meet their capacity because they don't put that little extra. They don't put their 4 hours in or their 8 hours in. If you do that little extra, if you find something you can like and enjoy, so you can give it that extra, you'll go to the top because most of the people are just there spending their time. That's pretty philosophical.
Well, if you looked around, that's what you see amongst your peers, too, I think. Now, what was it like, if you don't mind me going back and asking
sure.
a few more questions?
Sure.
We don't hear much about the China Marines. Like, what did you actually do when you were in China? What was it? Why were you there?
Okay, we were there taking Japan had occupied that area, and we were taking over from the Japanese. The war was over, the Japanese were there. I was there when I was asked to do. I was with the Seabees, actually. They took me because I was surveying. I went up and were putting stakes into the runway of enlarging the airfield in Tsingtao, China. And one of the cute things was we had a little mascot, a little Chinese kid, may have been 9, 10 years old. He'd meet us at the gate, and we'd take him with us and take him into Chow. And of course, his parents, I think, were just waiting for him to come home every night, so we always gave him some food to get back. And that's what I was doing. But while I was doing there, I used to go to services every Friday night, and I'm Jewish, and I'm not religious. But one of the things that you find in the churches, synagogues, you find language and things spoken that are very comforting rather than four-letter words that you will find at the bar, although I drank beer with the guys all the time. So I would do that, and when I was in Tsingtao, China, there was a community of Russians that came down from Harbin, and they had a little community in there. They were actually treated as a community by the Japanese, and they were going to build a little synagogue, and I built in the Orthodox religion, they build a little platform, and they separate the women from the men, and they have an ark. Well, being I was in the Seabees, I had access to these guys, these fellows who were not Jewish, at the shop, built me whatever I wanted, and I spent my days with a saw and a hammer building this little interior. And I used to remember they used to come around, never saw a young boy carpenter working. I was no carpenter, I was just handy. My dad was a builder, so I had to have some tools. And it was just a great experience because I was with civilians, and we would go out to eat. We'd put our fellows from barracks with money into a pot. We'd go and sit around and have a great feast with someone serving each of us around the hall. But that's what I was there. I was there serving at the airfield, and I had a great experience with the civilian population as well.
How long were you there for?
Not too long. I think I might have been there, and I can't tell you for sure, but I would think I was in Tsingtao. I was there one New Year's, came back. I would say about 5-6 months, maybe 5-6 months, something like that, at the time.
Did you ever run across any Japanese, either on Iwo Jima or POWs or in China?
I mean, afterwards?
During the battle on the island.
Oh, no, I could. You saw fire, but I never saw. I never did that. I never did. Never saw a live one.
What about in China after the war? Were they gone?
Yes. For me, yes, they were. In fact, I don't even remember any fighting at all. Not at all. I was patrolling, that sort of thing. One of the things I remember very clearly in Tsingtao is coming out of the mess hall. There was a a corridor that you came out of wire as you went out of the mess hall. And there were these 55-gallon cans of soap, rinse water, that you would take your gear, clean it, go down the line. And on each side of you, there were these Chinese young people begging for food that you shouldn't put into the garbage pail. I mean, these people were poor, poor, poor. They didn't have enough to eat.
What about the communists? Do you see any tension between the nationalists and the communists?
These were nationalists.
They were nationalists. Yeah.
This was the Kuomintang.
Chiang Kai-shek.
Right. That's who. This was being turned. Don't know of anything political. I myself was not aware of any. That was furthest from my mind was what was going on politically there. I didn't have any of those involvements at all.
Did you make it to Japan at all in your travels?
Not in service, but it was funny. I was very successful in this company that I joined as a salesman. I was a pretty good salesman, became sales manager. They had these incentive programs, and one of them was to Japan. We went to Japan. I went for Japan for 2 weeks. I went for a week with the company, a week on my own. And I didn't know how I would feel about that, facing people that you knew were enemies. And I'll tell you, I came back with admiration of the culture, the way I was treated, what I saw. It was the most marvelous trip I think I had taken with my wife. And we went all the way down, went to Kyoto. We went down to the very end of the islands. We had a marvelous, marvelous trip. And everywhere I went, I was comfortable. And I had nothing but admiration. To this day, I love Japanese food.
Yes, sir. I was wondering, the one thing that stuck out in my mind, the men that surrounded you when you arrived in Iwo Jima, what was really, the feeling of the troops? Did they have an idea of how important it would be as far as the battle they were about to fight? Or did you have that kind of respect for the Japanese culture, and was everybody prepared for the
fight? I don't think that, you're trained to do what you're to do, and you don't really weigh it upon, I didn't anyway, and I didn't see anything, I wasn't aware of anything, of other than, if somebody gives you a bayonet, you run a course, and somebody keeps shouting, make it louder, and tells you how to use that bayonet, and how to scream at that pole. And you do it over and over, and you're trained to shoot, and you're trained, disciplined to do what you're told to do. You go in not liking who's out there, and you're ready to, you're just going to get them before they get you, and you were doing it very patriotically. We had a cause, and we were going to do it. We knew about Pearl Harbor, and we knew about the guys that were coming back. We'd tell you stories, too. We had heard stories of how other people. So, but you weren't all jazzed up about those feelings. You were jazzed up about going in and doing what you were trained to do. And you were trained. I'll tell you this. They did a hell of a job of training, I think. They take a civilian and make a little war machine out of you very quickly. And when you hear of things that guys do, and how could they ever do it, you'd be surprised how you can be trained to do. You can be trained. You can be brainwashed pretty good in terms of doing your job, training wise. I wish all of you never have that experience. just travel, have a healthy, wealthy, and lovely family life.
It's not a big place.
No.
8 square miles, right?
You don't see any trees or anything, you just see... You saw black sand.
Black sand. You guys came in right through here, I guess, huh?
Right here.
Right here.
And you know, you're organized, too. You're told what beaches you're on. My group, I forget which beach, but there's a colored beach. They actually had flags that you could identify as you came of what beach you were coming up on.
Did you see the sand? We passed around that volcanic ash. I have a cousin who was in the Marine Corps, and he got to go to Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
And that's taken from Red Beach, too, I think.
That's...
Well, it looks familiar, huh?
Yes.
There's not much there today. I guess it's a Japanese air base.
Well, you know, this Iwo was, I think I was reading, was the first actual island that was really Japanese. I mean, that we really thought of as being part of Japan. I'm going to look here and see if there was anything here that I wanted to tell you. And I think I covered pretty much what I wanted to tell you.
You never went back, obviously.
Never went back. Oh, shouldn't say that. One of these promotional trips the corporation had was to Hawaii.
We went
to Oahu, and we got on a plane and flew to Maui, and I wanted to find the camp. And we drove around that place. Nobody never heard of the Marine Corps. I couldn't find anybody. I could never find our camp.
Really? Because Ralph Leanup, he was talking about a similar experience when he was in Maui, going back to Maui.
No, I couldn't do that. But that's a great shot.
You see the sand on the beach there.
Yeah. Yes.
And the traction.
Yeah.
Trying to get the traction in the soil.
Well, we came in, there was debris all through us, of vehicles, everything else was a mess.
Yes, it was shelled pretty badly, or 74 straight days, I guess.
Oh, you know, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable that the amount of shells that were flipped in there from battleships. Just, you couldn't imagine there'd be anything living on that island. But they were dug in these caves, and they had that whole beach registered. So when they came in, those boys, that first day, they slaughtered a lot of people. They certainly did.
Mr. McTagg, was your grandfather in the vicinity in his cruiser around Iwo Jima, you know?
I do not believe it was huge. Like you mentioned before, he doesn't like to talk about it pretty much at all.
Yeah.
That's why I know very little about his experience. It wasn't a very good one, and ship went down, so he never had to talk about it. So.
I can tell you that of the 3 years I was in the Marine Corps, almost half of them, a good part of it was at sea. And being a sergeant, I would stood sergeant of the guard duty on aboard ship quite a few times. And I'll remember the time that I was sitting, you're sailing, no lights, it's dark, and I heard I was called sergeant of the guard to the bridge. And I get up to the bridge, one of the guys at one of the turrets stepped off the wrong way, went into the drink. So a lot of things happen aboard those ships too. A lot of, you know, you try to talk about people doing a lot of things in close quarters, lots of things happen.
So, did you recover the guy that fell off?
No.
You just kept going, right?
Well, that's right. That's right. We were in convoy.
Right. You don't stop. Do you remember where you were when the war ended?
I really know.
How about the bomb? Do you remember when you heard about the atomic bomb?
Yes, I remember that. I was at Maui. The other interesting thing that happened when we got back from Maui, got back from Iwo to Maui, they gave us R&R on Oahu, and I had a week at the Royal Hawaiian right on Waikiki Beach with Diamond right there. That was real good duty for a week. But what you learned there was how sweet those people, the civilians were. The Hawaiians were just lovely, lovely people, and they couldn't do enough for us at that particular time. I mean, I felt that way anyway. Besides the beach, just going into a bar and sitting there, having dried shrimp just piled up in there, and everybody being very pleasant. That was again, you're so relieved to get out of the routine that it was a wonderful experience.
Did you ever get to Pearl Harbor when you were in Oahu? Remember?
No, we went there on R&R,
right,
and we could see, but I didn't get into doing any visiting. I just saw it. When we were Oahu was a wonderful island. We were there on this trip with Chrysler Corporation, who was our supplier, and we visited all around that island, and it was a beautiful island. The only other funny thing I can tell you about that is, while I was, you never tell your folks, you couldn't tell your folks where you were. And I was in Hawaii, on Maui, and the first care package I had, my sister sent me a can of pineapple. I thought that was funny.
You didn't eat it. No. They didn't know where you were, though, right?
No. And the other thing was the great, what was the email, I guess? What did they call
it? V-mail?
V-mail.
Victory
they
mail.
Were about this big and a little bigger. And they photostatted those and sent them around. That was fun in the sense that you got that. It was something, that some communication that you could get back.
Which one's Maui?
Well, this is Hawaii itself, the big island. Maui must be right in here, I think. Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure, but I think so. No? Try it again.
Getting closer.
Maybe we'll try all.
Honolulu?
Well, that's...
There's Maui.
That's Oahu. Try those all. Try that other one.
This one?
What is this?
Maui.
Is it?
This is Maui.
Yeah. The Japanese came in here and bought up a lot of